Nobel Prize for contributions to quantum planning. There's Nobel Prize for something. What he's really famous for is his work in quantum foundations. And today he's going to speak on the quantum realization paradox, theoretical considerations, and experimental inputs. Thank you very much.
Here, seeing all the enthusiasm for our here. I'm actually very informal talk, so please feel free to interrupt at any time. Crudely speaking, I'm going to basically stop at an arbitrary point, but where I haven't got to after 55 minutes. But crudely speaking, the first lecture was going to be qualitative, and in some ways probably rather controversial. The second part is going to be more technical and something less controversial, I suspect. Okay, so let's start off with something you're all very familiar with indeed, which is the question of inference strategies in quantum mechanics. So we imagine that we have some kind of set of microscopic, for the moment let's say microscopic systems. We can think of it as an atom, it could be electrons or neutrons or whatever. And these beasts are going to start off in some kind of initial state, which is totally well defined. And they're going to eventually arrive, among other possibilities, at some final state E. And they can do it via two different channels. The most obvious realization of the same affairs clearly is a traditional Young slits experiment where these two channels, B and C, correspond to two different slits in an intermediate slit. But it's much more generic. We could, for example, consider a case where we're talking about, say, K mesons, and these could, for example, be different strangeness states or different secret hybrid states, whatever. The important point is that, in some sense, we can choose to observe whether a particular system passes through channel B or through channel C, or we can choose not to. Okay, and what's the what do we learn experimentally in this situation? Well, we can do a simple experiment in the following way. First of all, we shut off channel B. How do we do that? Well, we have to assume, of course, some kind of basic physical knowledge. That is, for example, in the case of two physical slits, we assume that if we actually put a piece of paper material in one of them, then no particles are going to get through. We could actually check that in an experiment. We need to. Okay. Again, in the case of canvas, for a way, is for blocking off the expression plus one minus one check. So we assume we know how to do that. That is a fundamental assumption and interpretation of the data. So initially, then, we block off channel C, let's say, and we measure the probability, that is the relative number of particles which start off from A and arrive at E under that condition, between that being A goes to B goes to E. Similarly, we now shut off channel B, and in that way we measure the probability that the system goes from A through C. Now we overload the channels, and what do we find? Well, first of all, let's assume that we have some kind of inspection device like this to see whether we go through channel B or C. For example, I have the advice to put down a microscope, a flashlight on one of these channels, or a button. Under those conditions, we find a common sense result. The total number, which go from A to B, is the sum of the numbers which go through the channels individually. No problem. But what is important, I think it is important, although it's sort of trivial, is that each individual system is then found either to go through channel B or through channel C. Now, of course, we pull the road out of the hat, and we open both the channels, but not expect which channel is taken by any individual system apart. And under closed conditions, the experimental fact, and this is basically something which comes directly out of the raw data and without anything very much at least in the way of interpretation, the raw data tells us that the probability of arriving at under closed conditions is not necessarily simply the sum of probability of arriving at the future. course, if we were cleverer and set things up properly, we could actually ensure that we had a finite probability of arrival E, a non-zero probability when only channel B is open, non-zero probability when only C is open, and yet when we open both the channels, we get zero systems provided in total destructive interference. But that's the raw experimental data. Okay? Now, what that would seem to suggest rather strongly, I'll prove it, but what this would seem to rather suggest is a negative conclusion. Namely, that when we open both the channels, we cannot say it is the case that each individual particle went either through channel B or through channel C. Now, what we do say positively is that it is much more a matter of taste, if you like to say. Some sense that each system went through both channels, each system went through neither channels, the whole question is meaningless or whatever, but the one thing you can't say is that under those conditions, each individual system will have one channel or the other. Okay, so far? Okay, now we, so far we've had given no theoretical interpretation of what's going on. Now, because we come to the quantum mechanical description, and what quantum mechanical description tells us is that we should think not in terms of direct probabilities, but rather in terms of amplitudes. The total amplitude to arrive at E is simply the sum, the algebraic sum of the amplitudes to arrive to the two puzzles separately. And then the total probability is the square of the total amplitude. So now the total probability of arriving at E with both channels are open is this sum of amplitudes. Now when we square this, this R, we find that the square of A goes to B goes to E is the probability to go through B only. Okay? The square of the amplitude to go through C is the probability A goes to C goes to E. So far so good, but we've now got the famous or infamous interference term. And the interference term involves twice the real part of the amplitude for A goes to B goes to E times the complex conjugate of the amplitude for A goes to C goes to E. So it's this term only, which gives us, as it were, the non-common sense part of the result. And now what is the sort of trivial point, but what I'd like you to notice explicitly is that this term is automatically going to vanish unless both of these amplitudes are non-zero. And moreover, it looks as if, well, if you don't have a sense, it's a matter of interpretation, but remember that there are certain statements we can make which refer to individual particles, not just to the ensembles. For example, we can make the statement that no, under conditions of total destructive interference, no individual particle of the ensemble is ever going to arrive at E. So it does look as if these amplitudes, whatever their status is, must in some sense refer not just to the ensemble collectively, but to each individual particle. And yet, we know that if we, if we inspect, quantum mechanics, of course, doesn't say anything against this, if we inspect to see whether each individual particle came through B or C, then sure enough, it doesn't seem to be one pair. So we've got this rather peculiar situation at the microscopic level. So let me just recap that. At the microscopic level, the directly observed phenomenon of interference, if we take one of the capital description, implies that some kind of existence of amplitudes. The directly observed phenomenon of interference also, in some sense, implies, or so we argue, that neither outcome is definitely realized in the absence of observation. So at least it seems extremely tempting to conclude that whenever two amplitudes exist simultaneously, then in the absence of measurement, none of the two outcomes is definitely realized. That's a sort of negative conclusion. Now, let's go on with Schrödinger and his famous paper and try to set things up in such a way that if we follow through the standard description of quantum mechanics, of course, assuming that quantum mechanics is going to describe the whole setup, it's very, very important. Okay? What Schrödinger assumed in his original 1935 paper was that if I've got a macroscopic object, in this case a cat, that we could well think about, say, a Geiger counter or something like that Geiger counter is made up of microscopic objects such as electrons and atoms. We're pretty confident that electrons and atoms obey quantum mechanics. Therefore, the macroscopic objects made up of which also obey quantum mechanics. Right? So this is implicit in the argument. If we do that, and we follow quantum mechanics, then following Schrodinger's argument, we can generate a state in which some Maxwell object, as it can, it's like a closed box, is described in quantum mechanics by an amplitude. We set up a quantum mechanical, we set up an experiment such that if we follow through the quantum mechanical description, then at some stage, the universe, relevant part of the universe, is described by an amplitude which includes an amplitude for the cat to be alive, and simultaneously by a non-zero amplitude for the cat to be dead. Right? The question is, how do we interpret that special effect? Let me emphasize at this point. We often talk, and it's become traditional in the literature of the subject, to talk about the form of measurement paradox. But really, there's nothing special about measurement. What we're talking about is the realization or not of an outcome at the directly observable level. And we may not have accepted as a measurement. Among other, Schrodinger's cat would not be a very efficient measurement apparatus as such. Nevertheless, we are interested in whether we can say that one of the two macroscopically distinct states has been realized. In the same way, we're interested in knowing whether a counter, which has a pointer, which can be in two visibly different directions, is always going to end up in one direction or the other. Okay, so how do we respond to this state of things? Well, let's first consider the case. Incidentally, you'll see that some of you may have heard me talk on this subject before, you'll realize that I'm using partly a sort of standard talk. And I'm also going to supplement this with view graphs, which I'm afraid are probably not going to be quite as easy to read. Hopefully, you'll still be able to read them from back, but we'll see. So what are the possible hypotheses in this situation? Well, first of all, we do have to make a decision, explicitly, whether we are going to regard quantum mechanics as the whole truth about the world, or whether we're not. In other words, are we going to follow the argument of Schrodinger's work, that because quantum mechanics applies very beautifully to electrons and atoms, and because macroscopic bodies are made up of electrons and atoms, therefore it automatically follows that quantum mechanics applies to macroscopic bodies. Well, Schrodinger certainly did, and let's do that for the moment, at least. Right. So now we basically have to decide whether what the quantum mechanical amplitudes correspond to, whether they in fact correspond to anything at all out there in the real world. And in some sense, I think you can probably classify most of the standard interpretations of quantum formalism, depending on how they answer the question. Do quantum mechanics, the amplitudes of quantum mechanics, which are there in formalism, correspond to anything in the real world? First of all, at the microscopic level, and secondly, at the macroscopic level. Okay. Now, let me take these out of order. Right? At least until quite recently, perhaps even now, a very commonly accepted interpretation of formalism, what I call the orthodox, or decoherence formalism, decoherence interpretation, which basically says, yes, at the microscopic level, the amplitudes do correspond to something out there in the real world, but by the time you get to the macroscopic level, no, they don't. Okay, now, let's just think about that. Why do people try to make this argument? Of course, the answer is the phenomenon of decoherence. We all know that, by and large, microscopic systems are rather well isolated from their environments, or at least they are in the conditions of the normal experiments. And we have no particular difficulty in seeing interference between the two possibilities of both. For example, in the youngsters experiment between passage to Shen B and passage to Shen C. By the time we get up to the macroscopic level, the level of Geiger counters and cats and so forth, and then we all know that the system in question is probably strongly interacting with its environment, including in its environment internal liberties of freedom and so forth. As a result, it's going to be very difficult, in fact, usually impossible, to see any interference between the two possible outcomes. Now, as we'll see later in the second lecture, it is not always true, but it is true under the vast majority of conditions we're interested in particular. No one doubt, I think, you really, you know, the Animal Protection Society that actually allowed us to do the sort of cat experiment in meaningful, statistically meaningful way, then we would indeed fail to see any interference between the states that we did cat. So far so good. And let me emphasise, by the way, that those of us, including me, who object to the coherence interpretation do not object to the state. We agree that under most practical conditions, and certainly under all conditions that you could reasonably call a measurement, then it is indeed true that decoherence has come in and, if you like, previously randomised the relative phase, as you might have sophisticated than that, but quickly speaking, you can say randomise the phase in such a way that we don't see interference between possible outcomes. So far, so good. Now, here is the truth. At this point, the people who believe in decoherence, they often don't even bother to state this explicitly, sweep it under the rug. They say, okay, well, if there's no interference between these two possible outcomes, then there's no possible way of telling the difference between this description and the classical mixture description. A classical mixture description, I would say, each individual system has chosen definitely one path or the other, but I just don't know which. Okay? So it's a matter of classical ignorance. So they say all experimental predictions are exactly the same, therefore we might just as well say that one outcome or the other has been definitely realized. That's the truth. I believe, personally, most obvious defender of decoherence theory, unfortunately, is his left foot, I guess, hopefully one of the others. I tell him that this line of argument embodies a fundamental logical fallacy. At the microscopic level, we had a certain formalism, maybe the formalism of quantum mechanics, and we decided that we could not even interpret it. One thing we're not allowed to do is to interpret that formalism as telling us that each individual system took one path or the other. Why could we not do that? The experimental evidence which forced us to reject that interpretation is the phenomenon of interference. Now, by the time I get up from the level of electrons and atoms to the level of cats and counters, we will all agree that the experimental evidence on interference has in practice gone away. I can't see interference at this level. Nevertheless, nothing whatever has changed in the formalism of quantum mechanics itself. The structure is exactly the same as it was at the microscope. Therefore, the question arises, are we allowed to reject the evidence which forced us to reject a particular interpretation at the microscopic level? Are we allowed to change that? Because that evidence has now disappeared. This is a bit like asking, suppose we have a murder trial, and this guy's accused of murdering his wife, and there is a vital piece of evidence, let's say a bloody axe with his fingerprints all over it, and his victim's blood on it, etc., etc. So everyone says, for sure the guy's guilty, there's proof. Now, suppose that halfway through the trial, for some mysterious reason, this vital piece of evidence disappears. Does that suddenly mean that the guy suddenly becomes innocent? I don't think so. If he was guilty to start with, he's guilty now. So similarly, if you can't interpret quantum formalism in a particular way at the microscopic level, you are not entitled to interpret it in that way at the macroscopic level, no matter what's happened here. And this is, incidentally, I should say, my view on this, I think, is even stronger than that of the late John Bell, who I did talk to something about this. And John Bell's point of view was that the reason he didn't really believe in the decoherence argument, again, a very good one, I think, a very reasonable one, was that you could never be quite sure that at any level, macroscopicness, as it were, the possibility of seeing the interference has ever disappeared. And it's very, very obvious. If we look back in history, the possibility of seeing interference at a particular level of macroscopicness is very much a function of the existing technology. You'll see that in the second part of the lecture. So John Bell's argument there was, well, you just can't be sure that your argument is watertight because you can never be sure that someone would be clever enough to exhibit the interference. Yeah, sure.
So I once heard that during the experiment had been done with puppy pot.
I'll come to that. I'll talk about that in the second part of the link. So it is very much a function of existing technology. Now, I actually asked John before, if you could be completely assured that by a particular level, by the time you got to a particular level, there would be no longer any possibility of seeing the interference power match the technology improve, would you then be happy with the decoherence interpretation? And somewhat to my surprise, you said yes. Now, I'd say no. I'd say even if that's true, it still doesn't shape the logic of my argument. Now, okay, let me stop at that point for a moment and say one of the statements I've made in the last 5 minutes are somewhat controversial, and I'm sure certain people, if they were here, would sort of argue against them. Does anyone who is here want to wash your chins?
I just have a question.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand precisely what you mean by the decoherence interpretation. I want to put a specific case.
Okay.
You said that in the double slit experiment,
yes,
we cannot say the particle has gone through one slit or the other.
Well, not without some controls, which will come to that, yes.
Because we have this interference
evidence. Yes.
But we like to. Because that's our classical intuition.
Indeed.
So when you talk about the decoherence interpretation, is part of that the statement, well, when decoherence has happened, we can't talk about the particle going through one side or the other?
Yes, that would be my interpretation of the decoherence interpretation.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. But I think what you're saying, in some sense, refers implicitly to the consistent history interpretation, which I will, in fact, talk about later. Okay, so given that, then, I believe that, number three, the orthodox decoherence interpretation is a non-starter. So then we're left, crudely speaking, we're left with those interpretations which answer the question no at both the microscopic level and the macroscopic level. And those are, crudely speaking, what I'll call the non-exotic interpretations of quantum mechanics. And then we're left with the ones which answer yes at both levels, which are, crudely speaking, again, I'll call the exotic interpretations. Now, the extreme case is in the one case, are the what I would call the statistical or quantum information interpretation, and in the other case, the so-called Penny Wilkes interpretation. But there are other variants. Let me just say a brief word about that. Now, I suspect that you probably know at least something about some of these interpretations by other speakers here, but let me just so be fairly brief about this. If we go to non-exotic interpretations of quantum formalism, of course, the most familiar, and certainly in some ways the oldest, is the Cope-Hartley interpretation. Crudely speaking, takes the view that you're only really allowed to use quantum language at all at the microscopic level, so really this question doesn't even arise. So if you follow Niels Bohr or his disciples, what they will tell you is that quantum mechanics correctly described to describe the state of microscopic systems like atoms and electrons. And within that interpretation, it makes no sense to even try to interpret the amplitudes. All you can do is to use the amplitudes as a sort of calculus. But in order to use the amplitudes as a calculus, we've got to be able at the end of the day to measure something. So you've got to employ a macroscopic measuring apparatus. That measuring apparatus is of its nature macroscopic. And by the time you get to the macroscopic level, you're no longer allowed to use the quantum formula you've got to do in the classical language. Now, when Bohr said you've got to describe the macroscopic measurement apparatus classically, and like most things, Bohr said this many times, what he meant was, I think, not that you've got to describe it by Newton's equations of motion or Maxwell's laws or whatever, but rather you must be able to talk in the ordinary common sense language of the point of entry this or the point of that, and not in the language of quantum mechanical amplitudes and superpositions. Okay. So if you take that point of view, then, there is in some sense a fundamental distinction between the level of the microscopic level, which has to be described by quantum mechanics, and the macroscopic level, which has to be described by classical physics. The problem, of course, with that interpretation, as Schrödinger clearly realized, is that really, if you indeed believe that macroscopic objects are made out of atoms and electrons, there seems no clearer or obvious basis, certainly not within the quantum formalism itself, First, you can then dig a look and try to apply quantum mechanics to the eventual bodies. You may not have to do it, but you certainly are about to do it. So if that's the case, then of course you run straight into the Schrodinger's cat paradox and so forth. So that is sort of remedy that. We can go on somewhat with kernel-phonic interpretation and develop it in what I think is a more natural way. And I come to what I call the statistical interpretation. As I say, this is one which, in my experience at least, is widely embraced by certainly the young generation of quantum information theorists. Basically, the statistical interpretation said, well, yes, you shouldn't really. Any reality to the quantum category includes at all, not even not at the microscopic level, nor even at the macroscopic level. So even when I got up to the level of Schrodinger's cat, and I had this formal description in terms of a non-zero amplitude for the cat to go by, a non-zero amplitude for what you did, and so forth, there's no reality to those amplitudes. They're simply a calculation device, and in this particular case, what they allow you to calculate is the probability that when I open this particular box, I will see this particular cat be dead or genetically alive. And that's all there is to it. I mean, there's no more meaning to the amplitudes than there was to the formula which the ancient Chaldeans used to calculate the eclipse of the moon. It's simply a cookbook recipe. And, you don't know how to do this. Maybe we can. I think if you really take that seriously, it does give you a picture of the world, which is, to me, really rather silly. It basically says that, in some sense, the only thing to which you can reasonably ascribe any kind of traditional called reality is the event which we more or less directly observe at the macroscopic level. And that below that level, the whole question is meaningless. For example, to ask the question, what was the state of this particular cat before I opened the box and looked at it? Within that, if you really take that interpretation seriously, that's a meaningless question. There is no reality to be able to know. It's quite a real picture of the world. Maybe we have to look at it. Maybe, someone comes back, time traveler comes back in the year 3000 and tells me that in the year 3000, people are still going to believe in that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the physical world, and then ask me for my reaction to that. I think I'd have to fall back on that point of view, but as I say, it's really quite disturbing. Now, of course, you can try to attenuate the feeling of distance somewhat if you adopt something like consistent history's interpretation. And what consistent history's interpretation does, basically, is to assure you. If you, as it were, start from a level of direct observation, and then, as it were, try to extrapolate back in time, then you can, up to a certain degree, you can formulate a picture which would correspond to our ordinary classical notions of reality. Because if you start from the level of direct observation, clearly, well, apparently at least, no possibility of interference there. But if you go back a fair way towards the microscopic, still, you still have to go a fair distance before you really get any effects of interference. So basically this interpretation is safe, but as long as you you're fairly clearly in the regime where you didn't care about quantum interference effects, then a classical picture works well. Well, fine, that's okay, but it still doesn't, for me at least, really drive away the field of findings as well. Then of course you have, the other interpretation that you're sure you're familiar with, like the Bony-Rowley interpretation, and quite frankly, again I'll probably offend at least some people in the room if I say this, but quite frankly it seems to me that really the Bony-Rowley interpretation is little more than verbal window dressing on the basic paradoxes of quantum mechanics. What it does is simply to assert, in some sense, that yes, each individual particle did follow one trajectory of hour, but nevertheless, there are effects which would mean that you get the interference. And the way which this comes in, because it's very sophisticated, and the theory has been developed in a very elaborate way. But again, you get this problem. So suppose that, okay, according to the Bony-Rowley interpretation, when I got up to the stage of Schrodinger's cat, yes, each individual cat is definitely alive or dead. Nevertheless, they have to admit that some technology in the future might possibly enable you to exhibit the interference between these two states. And therefore, they've got to allow that there's still some form of reality to the part of the amplitude which is associated with cat, with the state which wasn't very light. So, you know, a particular cat is a live state. Nevertheless, there is still some amplitude corresponding to her being dead, and under, in the distant future, the appropriate technology that might play a role. The question is now, okay, but I think I've seen this particular cat for life. What's happened? What's happened to that amp? So you basically, I think, just got back to the same paradox inside of the language. There's only, going on now to slightly more exotic, the different varieties of interpretation, which sort of fall between or among these possibilities, and others have become exhausted all of them. Let me go on briefly, at least, to some of the more exotic or semi-exotic interpretations. There's one interpretation which I think is probably no longer very current, but at one time was believed by a fair number of people, is this, and I think Prigogine, for example, was the exponent of this. Basically, what distinguishes microscopic and macroscopic systems is that microscopic systems are not subject to irreversibility, whereas macroscopic, according to this claim, macroscopic objects are. And irreversibility, then, is a new ingredient in the problem, which introduces various qualitative new features, and in particular, once you've got sufficient irreversibility in your problem, you can say, effectively, that one outcome or the other is relevant. Well, this will be a viable interpretation if we believe that irreversibility really is a qualitative new ingredient in physics. Most of us don't, unfortunately. Most of us nowadays at least believe that irreversibility is something which follows perfectly naturally from the microscopic reversible laws, either classical mechanics or quantum mechanics. And by now, over the last 30, 40 years, we've done lots and lots of calculations in specific instances, which have shown you how you can start with a perfectly well-defined microscopic Hamiltonian of a system of its environment, perfectly reversible, perfectly considered. And you can start off with that, and you can do your calculation, and let's suppose, for example, that the system in question is a pet, and the environment, in this case, might correspond to the degrees of freedom of the pet, or something like that. What happens is simply that the energy, which is initially associated with the motion of the macroscopic body, is gradually and irreversibly transferred into the heat energy of the environment. So sure enough, the pebble swim down and the pebble will keep up. And as I say, you can actually do these calculations, nothing mysterious about that at all. And so I think most of us these days, at least, would be very reluctant to believe that irreversibility as such introduces any physically new problem. So if that's true, then really the irreversibility solution or interpretation reduces to a form of the decoherence on the subject of the same kind of criticism. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it has any relevance, but I was under the impression that there is real irreversibility in the weak interactions.
Real irreversibility in the weak interactions?
Yeah.
Oh, I think what you're thinking of here, I wouldn't say it's irreversibility. The statement which people normally make, if they don't think too hard about it, is that all the fundamental laws of physics as we know them are invariant under time. Now, it does turn out that there's a small part, of the weak interaction which fails to be invariant under time loops. And it's occasionally been argued that could be relevant to the general problem of irreversibility. I think I have to say right now the majority of people would be that it's something different, especially, but it's conceivable. But at least, let's just assume for the sake of argument we didn't know about this part of the interaction, we'd still have the same problem. So very briefly, a few more exotic. Yeah. I think the difference is simply that, in some sense, the statistical interpretation simply takes the Copenhagen interpretation more seriously than the Bullen-Heisenberg interpretation, in the sense that the Copenhagen interpretation says, okay, you're allowed to apply quantum mechanics to microscopic objects, and when you do, the amplitudes have no significance, so a calculation device. But by the time you get to talking about, say, the behavior of a classical measuring apparatus, measuring apparatus, you've got to use classical physics, and you've got to, as it were, stop using the quantum performance. Now, the statistical interpretation says that's illogical. After all, these measuring apparatus is a physical object. It's made up of atoms and electrons. We should, whatever we say about the microscopic level, we should say about this. So even at the macroscopic level, it says you're still talking to the amplitudes, but they have no physical scale. So very briefly then, just a couple of exotic, more exotic interpretations. I think, to my mind, one of the most exotic interpretations is one which Schumann proposed a few years ago, which I call the Calvinistic interpretation. And Schumann started from the observation that if I have a definite macroscopic outcome, let's say, for a measurement, then I could always run Schrodinger's equation backward in time and arrive at a particular study of the apparatus, the environment, etc., which is guaranteed to give exactly that outcome. And so his postulate, very crudely speaking, was that inevitably, whenever an experimenter starts off to make a measurement, he or she always finds the apparatus and the environment to be exactly that right state, to give an exact outcome. Well, clearly, it's a very peculiar interpretation, at least at first sight, because if you believe it, then that says, in effect, that the illusion which the experimenter was under, that he or she had free will in setting up the experiment in a certain way, is an illusion. Okay? So in other words, everything is predetermined. That's why I call it the Calvinistic point of view. So that's one very exotic interpretation. The second one, of course, is the mentalistic interpretation, which is being broached, I think, certainly not touched by people like Wiener, which say, well, quantum mechanics is fine to describe the physical world, but we as human beings, as conscious human beings, are not part of the physical world, and therefore when consciousness or mind or whatever comes into it, then we have to choose a radically different description, and it's actually the act of human observation which checks it. The moment a human observer comes in and looks at Schrodinger's cat, then, the superposition is reduced, and you get one outcome or the other. I didn't say very much about that. It always seems to me that since our theory, as at least my knowledge, our theory of human consciousness is in an even less satisfactory state than our theory of religion and quantum mechanics, it's a bit like two drugs trying to pop one another up in this case. But you never know. Finally, of course, now again, it's both pedals and tones here, I guess we get to the many worlds interpretation, which is in some sense the most exotic of the exotic interpretations, according to which the quantum mechanical attitudes do have a real meaning, not just that they do correspond to something in the real world, not just at the microscopic level, but actually at the macroscopic level too. So, well, the sort of crude formulation would be that I open the box, I open this particular box, and I think that I see this particular cat a lot. According to the many worlds interpretation, it's a really sophisticated form. There is nevertheless a parallel universe which is equally real, frequently observed, in which that cat is dead. And moreover, not just as she did, but I observed her to be dead, and my friends observed her to be dead, etc., etc. Now, so long as the many worlds interpretation, except what we call it, is simply a statement about the consistency of the quantum theory, that is, provided only a statement to the effect that if I see this particular cat be dead, then it's automatically guaranteed by the formula from quantum mechanics that my friends will also see that it's etc., etc. Then, of course, there's nothing against it. But if it's to be taken seriously as a piece of metaphysics about the real world, when it is said that these alternative universes of which we are not conscious are, quote, equally real, unquote, those words, equally real, sound like English. What does it mean? Okay. If anyone's interested in a copy, I will give you a little thought experiment to prove that you don't really, that those of you who think you believe this, but the rules of interpretation don't really believe it. So come on. Okay, so much for that. So all of these interpretations, we have to embrace one of these interpretations or some alternative interpretation if we've decided that we really believe the quantum mechanics are true. Well, let's get back around. So
you just said that if we believe quantum mechanics is the truth, we require an interpretation. Do we really require an interpretation at all?
Well, no. I mean, in some sense, I think you could say what I call the extreme statistical or quantum information theory. Interpretation is not interpretation. It's just a, as it were, a prescription as to how to use it. So I think that's the, if you like, that's the least, it has the least metaphysics involved in it, of all the various possibilities. But, I mean, look, you may not be requiring interpretation, but you presumably don't use quantum mechanics in your everyday work. And so you do at least need a prescription to apply. If you like, I think, in some sense, you could say the quantum information of the regular interpretation, quote, interpretation, is little more than a set of prescriptions. Okay. Suppose we take a point of view. Suppose we take a point of view that quantum mechanics is not truth about the world, but rather that at some stage between the level of atoms and electrons and the level of cats and counters and our own consciousness, something else, one of our specified, comes in. Something which is quite different from quantum mechanics and qualitatively changes the picture. And in particular, qualitatively changes the picture in such a way that we get a natural evolution of a quantum mechanical superposition into a different state. Now, as some of you will know, there have been a number of such hypotheses floated in the literature, and some of them are really quite specific. The most specific of such alternative scenarios is the GWP theory. And in that, crudely speaking, it's pretty, we don't have the thoughts on to talk about that because you can explain it as I can, but crudely speaking, in that interpretation, that scenario, alternative scenario, not an interpretation of the thing, that scenario, what happens is that you have a universal noise background, which is not itself described by quantum mechanics. It's very, very crucial. So as a result of the interaction with this noise background, you get a nonlinear term, a Schrodinger equation, which then drives a superposition automatically by the so-called Galois-Lewin process into one another of its branches. And what is rather nice about this interpretation, well, the attractive feature of it is the following. You have a distance, a characteristic distance scale, which comes into the theory, which in the current version of the theory is something like 10^-5 cm, but you also have a time scale. And the time scale, crudely speaking, is somewhere beyond the edge of the universe. So what that means is that if I have a superposition of two different states, or a microscopic body, like say a neutron or an electron, then it's going to take something way over the edge of the universe for that superposition to be resolved. So for example, if I have a photon is particle, maybe massive, but I have a photon coming from the most distant quasar that I can currently see. Quantum mechanics would say that that photon is in a linear superposition of various states, and in particular, I can put it through a microscopic barometer and see the interference between these two states, despite the fact that these two beams, as it were, have been on the road for something like 10^9, 10^10 years. And the GWP theory maintains that result. However, what's very, very interesting is that it just pops out quite naturally out of the general structure of the formalism that the time taken for reduction of the superposition is that characteristic time divided, crudely speaking, by the number of particles which are behaving differently in two branches. Now, imagine that we have a Schrodinger's cat situation. So in one state, the Schrodinger's cat is sitting up at the union cabinet and so forth, and the other is some vapor. So clearly something like 10^23 particles are behaving differently in those two states. So that means that your characteristic time, whatever it was, 70 years, is divided by this huge number. And as a result, the time taken for the superposition of Schrodinger's cat to transform into one state or the other by this mechanism is something you'll realize, much faster than any possible time of human observation. But I'll say that's not built into the theory, it comes out in a very natural kind of way. So that's probably the best ability of this theory, is we want to talk specifically about experiments to test that particular version. But I'm going to do, in the rest of this talk, I'm going to talk to do something a bit more general. I want to talk about the general concept of macro-realism. Basically, what I define the class of macro-realistic theories as alternative scenarios to quantum mechanics, which say that for some reason or another, not necessarily specified, macroscopic bodies cannot be or cannot survive for any length of time in states which are macroscopically distinct. In particular, Schrodinger's cat cannot survive. She can't persist in this superposition of alive and dead states. That is more than most trivial times. So I'm not going to specify exactly why that is here.
So when you're saying like these things collapse after a certain amount of time, it just makes me wonder, so what if we were to measure before this time came up? What are we supposed to be seeing?
Well, if you really measure a state of a macroscopic object on a time scale of the order of, say, a nanosecond, then you might be able to you would still expect to see the quantum mechanical interference. And then after that characteristic time, it would have released one right or the other, you no longer can see it.
I guess I'm not sure what a cat interfering with itself would look like.
Okay, well, perhaps we should, forget this level of specificity, we should probably think perhaps about a non-mechanical oscillator or something like that. I'll cover that.
How does that differ greatly from the nature of decoherence?
Thanks very much. Good question. I want to put it the following way. I should say there's been a lot of historical misunderstanding about this. When Girardi, Rebner, and Weber first wrote their paper, a lot of people understood it as being simply a variant of a decoherence approach. It wasn't, and I think certainly they, and even more explicitly Pearl, realized very clearly that it wasn't virtually this. In the decoherence theory, you believe that the formulas of quantum mechanics is actually sacrosanct, will persist to whatever level of macroscopicness or whatever you want, and then you try to argue that nevertheless you can have one on one of the outcomes realized. Of course, as I'm sure quite tectonic, there have been all sorts of interesting technical developments along those lines. The GLWP theory and similar macro-realistic theories are very different in the sense that they actually say, no, quantum mechanics is not there is something else. We don't know what necessarily. I mean, the GLWP theory, you sort of know what, but in most of the theories don't. There's something which comes in. And in such a way that objectively, you can see this superposition evolving into one or other of its branches. Generally speaking, such a theory is a continuous process. You start off with a single position, and then by some kind of random process, one branch or the other gets attenuated, and you finally double one branch. Yeah.
So,
yes.
So, do you know how the time? How the time compares in the two theories?
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't here to hear what he was taught, but from what I know of previous writings on it, I'll assume that the question of how long it takes for decoherence to be effective is very much a function of the specific physical situation we're talking about, in particular with of the degree of contact of the system with its environment. And remember, the environment is a very generic term which includes basically any degrees of freedom you're not specifically interested in. So for example, I think kind of one of his favorite examples is Hyperion. Did Wojciech talk about the planet, the asteroid Hyperion? One of his examples is Hyperion. This is an asteroid which is a nasty shape and it's tumbling in a complicated way. And the claim is that if you were really to take quantum mechanics of an isolated object seriously as regards that system, then after not very long time, a few years, you would end up in a quantum superposition of very different configurations. And then of course, the decoherence argument comes in and say, well, it's not us, it's being subjected to bombardment from radiation and so on and so forth. And as a result of that, it does effectively work as But it depends very, 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 very critically on exactly what kind of system you're talking about and how substantial its contact with its environment is. And in fact, we'll see that coming up very clearly in the example I'll give in a second. So, you have a question?
I do. Thank you. So, just to clarify even further, so both decoherence and what you're calling macro-realistic theories say that linear superpositions of macroscopic objects can't exist or can't persist. But you're specifically defining macrorealism to be theories that modify the unitary dynamics of quantum mechanics somehow?
So what does it does it collapse into one brother one? Does it evolve into one brother?
Yeah.
But I mean, then don't you have a sort of preferred basis?
Sure, you do, in fact. And indeed, in the geography theory as currently formulated, the preferred basis is connected with the bioelectric central mass of the bottom question.
I don't see how you avoid these interpretational problems before this collapse that's possibly don't you have basically quantum mechanics still?
Well, yeah, in some sense you have quantum mechanics up to a certain stage, and then something else. Typically, and it's not essential, typically in macro-realistic theories, you have some kind of effect, sometimes unspecified, which is always there. It's there at the level of atoms and electrons, but it's very, very weak. And it's only as you amplify these states to states where some macroscopic objects behave in different energy branches that it really starts to bite and become effective. So, sure. Now, you wouldn't have any interpretation problems, I think, because it's more or less guaranteed in such theories that by the time you've got up to the point where you can reasonably say you've got a directly observable outcome, then the superposition has got extra quantum charges. Yeah.
You said that for some microscopic systems these superpositions can endure for long.
Yes, yes.
What happens if you actually measure it?
Well, then basically, up to a certain point, you apply a view of quantum mechanics, and you involve the. What you've done is that you correlate the states of your microscopic object to those of the measuring apparatus. Then the measuring apparatus is itself a macroscopic object, and therefore is very rapid. Superposition is reduced.
Just what about the microscopic system? You should be able to measure that again.
I think you find in theory that indeed you get exactly the results that the standard application of quantum mechanics with the measurement force would produce. Mm-hmm.
So, whereas in the decoherence picture, a macroscopic superposition decoheres into a mixed state. And in the GRW, we have a fundamental physical process that collapses me, so to speak, into one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's a random process, as you pointed out, to agree with observations.
Yes.
So I don't know which it's in.
You don't know which it's
in. I don't know which it's
not
collapsing. And this or this, and I don't know which, is operationally the definition of a mixed state.
Okay, good point. Well, you basically, come to my next point. I think perhaps what might be a good idea is if I stop at this point and just take perhaps 5 minutes for any formal questions and then you can break up the topic slide again.
I was just going to ask you, can you see any like immediate sort of generic problem with these macro-realistic
For the which thing?
The right thing.
Oh, okay, thank you. That was good. Something that comes to me. From the a few minutes ago.
This macro-realism, it seems appealing when I think about really small things like electrons and then large things and pointers, but what about something in
the absolutely. And that's what we're going to explore in the second half of the talk.
Any more questions at this stage?
Is there any idea what the non-quantum situation theory would be?
Well, I mean, if you believe they have a very specific form of the noise and most that direction, and I can tell you what its correlations are, etc. What it actually represents, I think, is a question they certainly can't answer. But then you see, in some sense, I don't want to be totally surprised that they are, after all, some real hardwired skeptic were to come to you and say, we all believe that Newton's law would work, and so forth. But what does the second law actually mean? What is the mechanism behind it? That's not the kind of question, I think, that at least at the current state of physics we can answer. And we can maybe rephrase it more elaborately in terms of Lagrangian, etc., etc., but we can't really answer that kind of question. So again, I think if you really reach it together, you've got that point, so to ask where it comes from, it's really not.
Is it a field?
Yeah, it's a physical field, but the way it interacts with ordinary matter is really rather different from the linear interaction of ordinary electromagnetic fields. Yeah.
Can I ask you again what you really mean by statistical implications? Does that mean to ask amplitude for every event? And I have rules for combining amplitudes?
Correct, yes.
And that's it.
And then I have
about the right hand side of the theory, which allows me to calculate amplitudes.
You've got this enormously elaborate scheme which allows you to calculate amplitudes under any given physical conditions. Of course, at the end of the day, you've got to be able to say how you're going to use those amplitudes, and the way you use those amplitudes is just as in the standard fundamental. So the square of the amplitude is the probability that they'll observe.
Okay, so I have the impression that, that this view was expounded a number of times by Richard Feynman. As far back as the 60s.
Oh, yeah, yes. Oh, sure. I mean, this is not, in some sense, not in your son, the interpretation of quantum mechanics. I think if you go back to this, the person who, well, the person who's usually credited with having, sorry, I was going to say something that was irrelevant. Let me just make this more anyway. I mean, of course, say nothing to you, the idea of decoherence itself for a long time. The person that I think who historically has given credit for that is Ludwig. I tried to read Ludwig's article and I can't actually quite find it, it's there, but then people do have a habit of sort of doing things out of history, which I may not see more physical side. But at the same time, I think in the same period, I think people were beginning to take seriously something like this particular interpretation. I would say the person, historically, the person who I think, in some sense, most put it on the map from the point of view of the general physics community, might have been Leslie Valentine, in his paper in the Use of Modern Physics in 1970. I would say that's the very trenchant statement of this statistical interpretation, and I think it's been quite influential. But I'm sure there'll be not a lot of people.
Yeah, maybe I'll get to this in the second part of your talk, but I'm wondering if the characteristic time that is a part of the GRWP theory, was this found by sort of working backwards to just have it be whatever it needed to be, or is this somehow derived from more?
No, it's taken by working backwards. They have these two parameters, which are a bit like H bar instead of point. So you have no H bar or what H bar is in Earth's sentence. So here you have no priori margin of this characteristic length scale or characteristic time scale. What you have to do is to try to fit them in such a way that you preserve all the results of quantum mechanics that we know and love because they've been experimentally verified at the microscopic level, and at the same time give a mechanism by which Schrodinger's cat can end up with in real life, etc., etc.
So is there a lot of wiggle room right now?
One of the interesting things about the GRWP theory is not wiggle room. And in fact, there's a small group of people who are actually trying to do experiments to either extend it or knock it off. Yeah. Sorry, why don't you go first?
Okay, so in this GRWP theory, is the normalization is constantly going down, right?
Okay, that's a nasty point. You have to, of course, if you're going to, as it were, try to preserve as much as possible quantum mechanical scheme, then as one of the amplitudes starts to dominate over the other, you do have to make sure that the normalization is preserved. And Philip has a whole lot devoted to that point. You have to, yes, but you want to cause cooking, I think. You have the raw amplitudes and then the cooked amplitudes. So you have to.
So is it that while some of the amplitudes are going down in absolute magnitude, some of them are going up or not?
Yes, yes, some will be down. That is the sort of renormal of the cooked amplitude.
So I'm not explicitly renormalizing it, but by hand.
If I recall correctly, you have to, you do actually have to put in the renormalization explicitly in the general theory.
I just wondered,
is
this like a
theory
in your talk, but can you give any other examples of macro-realistic science derivative?
Oh yeah, sure. They're not as well developed, but they exist. Probably one of the earliest was covering houses, which I don't know, to be honest, I don't know a great deal about the technical details of that, but that was I believe, based on the idea that gravitational fluctuations would play a special role. And a more recent version of the same general idea of Penrose's. He believes that what is going to affect the reduction, or the criterion for when a reduction is going to take place, is, and I think I'm just right, is when the gravitational energy associated with the difference of two configurations, which might both occur, for example, in the dead state of Schrödinger's cat, when that gravitational energy is of the order of the energy of one graviton. Is that not
that's certainly one of the criteria.
Yes.
But it's most with the whole time.
Sorry?
With the whole time life loop. That is the difference in energy times the time that you accept.
Right, yes. So that put off appropriate sort of frequencies. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So there are other people have this whole idea of macro-realism, which is a non-new one, and a lot of people have proposed vague or qualitative. But I think of the various versions, certainly the geodetic WP one is the one which is most developed quantitatively. Yes?
Do you think that the amplitude of the cloud is
going to be